Welcome to Opera San Jose, Opera Talks. This is a podcast about Lucida Lammermoor, and we're recording this on September 14. I have with me today Kirk Doherty, who is singing Edgardo in Lucia, and I have Matt Hanscom, who's singing Enrico. Well, guys, the two of you have been in Opera San Jose's resident company for 2 years, each of you, and are now beginning your third year. During that time, you've become real audience favorites, and I must tell you that both of you are a real pleasure to have in our company. Not only are you consummate professional singers who deliver brilliant performances, you are also the very best of colleagues. And that may sound like copy, but I mean that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's all true. Okay, so Matt, the way I add it up, you have starred in 8 productions. And now you're in Lucida Lammermoor singing Enrico, a big ugly one. That's your 9th. So looking back on this, is there a production that you were most fond of during the past couple of years?
I mean, Rigoletto is a role that's on every baritone's bucket list. So that, and we started, that was my very first production here. So in a way, it would have been nice to have that been further down the road where I had more time to sort of season here. But it was still a real treat to sing Rigoletto. But I got to say, my favorite production has been Tosca and singing Scarpia.
You scared me so bad as Tosca. I was worried about your wife and child.
Well,
that's the line.
Yep.
I was sitting up there and it says, oh my God, he has a wife and child at home.
Well, the one that sort of disgusted my wife the most was Stanley Kowalski. But there is something about the pure evil of Baron Scarpia that should probably worry people.
If I could sing any role, if my voice could have handled Iago,
exactly,
I would have chased a career in opera.
Nice. Yep. But, Iago is purely evil person. Doesn't want to see anyone else happy. Just wants to squish Otello.
Just ruin the guy.
Yep, just because he's happy.
And he does.
Yep.
He does it. Kirk.
Yes.
In your first 2 years, you sang 3 operas because you were away as a guest someplace else for one of them.
That's
every
true.
Time. And now you're singing Edgardo.
Yes.
Do you find that there is a production that you hold most dear?
Yeah, actually, I mean, notwithstanding this particular production right now, I would agree with Matt that I loved The Duke in Rigoletto, and I loved Cavaradossi in Tosca as well. And so, yeah, it's true that in some ways Matt and I have been adversaries in many of our favorite productions, and in some form of adversary.
Yeah. He nearly killed you in a show, as I recall.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But by far, this current production, Lucia di Lammermoor, is fantastic, and I really have enjoyed this very much.
I have to add to that, I think this production of Lucia is among the most exciting productions that has ever been produced at Opera San Jose. Oh,
thank you very much.
It's thrilling.
Yeah.
Audiences. I've had people come up to me at intermission on Sunday. A lady came up to me during the first intermission to say how wonderful this was, and she started tearing up, and she couldn't talk, and she had to walk away.
Wow.
And at the second intermission, a woman came up, and we started talking, and she started tearing up. Now, she was able to talk, but she then had to give me a big hug.
Wow.
She says, I need a hug.
Yeah.
So this thing is killer. This thing is killer. And the reviews are reflecting exactly that.
Yeah.
Exactly
Very
that.
Pleased. Very pleased about
that. Well, there it is. Sylvia Lee.
Fantastic.
She's exquisite.
I mean, when it's called Lucia di Lammermoor, you kind of need to have the lights out Lucia. And she's really doing a fantastic job.
Everybody thinks, however, that Lucias are the hardest thing. Oh, my God, where are you going to ever find a Lucia to say, well, I believe that the hardest role is Edgardo.
Okay. Yeah, that
I
too.
I think finding an Edgardo is harder than finding Lucia. Thank there are you. More sopranos out there who can do that than there are tenors who can do Edgardo.
Well, the stamina, and it's also the sort of the color palette that you have to draw from. I mean, just speaking from someone who listens, I don't sing the part. I've got Kirk here who does that. But, I mean, you have to be able to go from, you know, melancholy to, you know, floating high notes in love duets, and then the heaviest spinto stuff in sort of the standoffs with Enrico. So it's a...
Yeah.
It's daunting, just kind of the dynamic range that you have to bring.
Yeah, there's a lot of development even in the vocalism. Yeah, I mean, you...
And the thing that strikes me in this opera is that nobody is ever unalloyed.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything you're doing, you're of two minds.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing, you're regretting that you're doing it, but you have to do it.
Yeah, it's a very emotion-driven scene.
For all of the leads, including Raimondo.
Yeah.
Speaking of Raimondo, Colin Ramsay.
Amazing. Amazing
fantastic job. New residents that have come. I mean, I couldn't be happier about who's joined us this season. Actually, every single one of them.
Yeah, and ensemble's
today,
great.
Today, Brian Meyer is in town.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so that's
I'm
cool.
Totally excited. I mean, this is, I'm going to be a bad guy and just go ahead and say this. I don't recall ever Opera San Jose having a resident company that was so evenly talented.
Yeah, that's great. I appreciate
it's
that.
It's just one of the most talented groups of people I have ever seen in one place. And you're going to be here for a whole year.
Yeah, really pleased.
It's totally exciting.
Nowhere else like it in the United States. So it's fantastic.
Well, I think we're doing what we meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
I occasionally get, just today, I got a recommendation from a guy that I went to college with who's now a voice teacher. And he says, oh, do you know about this guy? Well, it just happens that Ben Spearman, who directed Lucia, also recommended the same guy just a couple of days ago before he left. Yeah, he told Corey, Ricky told me. Mm-hmm. So here's this guy that we need to look up. But the whole point is to take people who ought to be singing leading roles on major stages. That's the point.
That's great.
And then give them some leading roles so that they might be able to do that. Because it's one of these chicken and egg things, right?
It's exactly what
it is. They won't
let
you sing a major role until you've sung a major role. So how do you do that?
Yeah.
So that's
tough business.
Yeah.
It is a tough business. Yeah. No, to make the debut and to make the important debuts at a place like this is it's been integral in going to the next steps of a career.
Yeah.
It's really great. Because
you have the reviews.
Yeah. And the experience.
People liked me. I've done 6 performances of everything.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's unusual for anybody to do 6 performances.
One of them, like on 12 hours rest?
You know, yes, the opening weekend. Do the opening weekend back-to-back performances. Really, really stellar.
Which we never used to do.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Back when we had 2 resident casts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure, right.
Everybody got 4 performances.
Right, right.
But there was no back-to-back singing.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And we did 8 shows.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody got 4.
And yeah.
No back-to-back. Irene didn't believe in any back-to-back singing.
Yeah.
Well, the back-to-backs are a little crazy, but that opening weekend is so important because, like we've been discussing, some of those the reviews that come in are beneficial for our careers.
Yeah.
You don't want to give those up. So.
No.
And I mean, we come through with flying colors. Just speaking.
Yeah. Sylvia was fantastic.
Fire. Exactly.
On Sunday.
Was on fire.
I mean, amazing.
Go to bed, sleep 6 hours, get up, go back to the theater.
Yeah. It's like one long show with a nap. Yeah, it's definitely that.
A little behind the scenes of Opera San Jose, usually there's an opening night party that we can't really attend too well because we do have to turn around and do the show the next day on a Sunday. But for this production, there's a closing night party, so that gets rid of all that fatigue from the opening.
Yeah, I got
I think that's a very wise move.
Yeah.
I canceled the opening night receptions.
Yeah. I think that's
yeah,
very good.
That's a great idea.
Because I was always walking around the singers saying, go home.
Right.
Yeah.
Go home.
Exactly.
So, I will. Another glass of champagne.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, no, go home.
Yeah, that is right. That is true.
So, because singers are loquacious.
Yeah, and you do want to talk to the patrons who are there and in attendance. We have such a loyal group of patrons. Really grateful to that too.
Our people know the thing that has always been so satisfying for me. We used to do the Irene Dallas vocal competition once a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we had 10 finalists. There were 3 days of people singing, and a group of judges came and picked the 10 they thought were the best.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then here we go. We have 3 new judges who are going to pick 3 of those, and the audience could vote for the one they wanted. The audience never once chose anybody but the best singer. Every single time they chose the best singer on the stage. And it wasn't about their favorite who was with Opera San Jose, because very often an Opera San Jose, maybe 3 Opera San Jose singers would be qualified to do this. But they always picked the best one, whether it was from Opera San Jose or not from Opera San Jose. They were never wrong. Judges were often wrong. They would give the first prize to somebody that were going, huh? But the audience, never wrong.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have an agenda. You don't know what anybody's connections are with people in the business or whatever, but the audience is only about who has connected with me on that stage
right now.
So really, their vote, they should get 5 votes. It should be a weighted vote.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's true. Was all pretty exciting for me. Well, we kind of talked a lot about Lucia. Talk to me, Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
Edgardo.
Yeah, interesting character, a lot of brightness and a lot of darkness. Yeah, he's a romantic character. He's in love with Lucia, and yet he's nursing a really painful grudge of having lost his homeland and his estates,
family estates, and his family.
And his family, yes, his father's dead. He's the last of his line, his ancestral line, and he meets this beautiful woman who happens to be the sister of his rival and now new owner of his estates. They fall in love, and he meets her before he leaves to go to France to find some allies and return and decide the fate
to
of
kill
Scotland.
Her whole family.
Yes, but before he does, he secretly becomes betrothed to her. He says, "You are my wife. God sees us. God hears us. We take our vows to one another in secret."
And you know, in the Middle Ages. And I don't know how long into history this was true, but in the Middle Ages, that's all it took.
Yeah, yeah.
You were married.
Yep.
In the eyes of heaven and mm-hmm. earth, it was binding. You couldn't get out of it.
That was enough witnesses. and so then he departs, and he's on his way. In the meantime, there is a marriage that ensues for Lucia and an ally of Enrico, Arturo Bucklaw. And upon returning, Edgardo... bursts into this wedding, which she is forced into. It's not of her will that she is trying to sign this contract. And he's presented the contract, and basically he curses the entire family. And that is one giant wedding crash.
as Lucia's brother, I think that's perhaps the most interesting role. His life is at stake here.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very complicated part, especially because it is, from the novel, it is the entire Ashton family is boiled down
into
Enrico in the opera. Yeah. So in the novel, you have William Ashton, who's a lawyer, and he's sort of calculating, but he also has a great affection for Lucia. And you also have Lady Ashton, who is sort of a Lady Macbeth, really nasty character who wants to ruin her daughter's life by marrying her off to another man. It's all boiled in. And then Lucia has two brothers in the novel as well. Henry is actually her younger brother. And she has an older brother named Sholto, and they're all condensed into Enrico in the opera. So he's a multifaceted guy, yeah. And he has a lot of regret for what he has to do. But in the end, when you're faced with extinction or putting upon your sister like an unwanted marriage, you do what you have to do.
Marriage had nothing to do with love.
Yeah.
No, exactly.
And frankly, I wonder now if it does. But, but both of you are married, though. So
I assure you
this is true. Yes.
Yeah, I was married for a few years, and it was all about love, too. In the Middle Ages, it never was. I don't care what part of the class you were from. If you were the miller's daughter, you had to marry somebody who was better than a miller. And if you were the Comte de Guise, your son had to marry a duke.
Yeah.
And if it did have to do with love, as we find out
daughter of a duke.
In this opera, it doesn't end too well.
Yeah, it ends with feuds and violence. Yeah.
In the 18th century, it was so expected. This is one of my favorite little anecdotes. It was so expected that your marriage would be loveless.
Yes.
That a guy walked into his wife's bedroom, and there she was in flagrante with her beau. And he says, "Madam, lock your doors. That could have been anyone walking in here." So it was just presumed that you were going to get your love elsewhere.
Right.
And this was about money and position and proximity to the crown.
But anyway, it's a very special and unique kind of pressure that he's under. Anyway, is the, you know, the extinction of his family name, of his wealth and the power and the influence that his family holds in their country. And I don't know that it sort of exists today. If you
not
can,
in the
if
same
you feel
way,
really
no.
that kind of pressure. I mean, maybe if somebody had, I was trying to think, like, what does this feel like now? Like, if you were, I think there might be something to, like, a family-run business. If you've built it over generations and generations, and you have a business that your family started, and there are people that have been working for you like their entire lives, and they've become part of your family, and you're faced with bankruptcy, the company's not doing well, or whatever, you have to shut the doors. There's probably, because of course he has dependents. Enrico would have dependents that lived in his castle, and they're all depending on him to make this, you know, truce with Arturo so that they can continue living in the style that they're accustomed. Mm-hmm. And it's probably that might have something to do with it, but then there's death and exile.
Well, but the real issue is death. And for folks who don't know that what we have done to the opera, because we have messed with this opera, there's a mistake in the libretto. When Sir Walter Scott wrote The Bride of Lammermoor, he set it in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
And the first edition sold out in 2 weeks. So there had to be a second printing. But he decided to make it a second edition. And he'd moved the time to the 18th century. So he moved it from 17th to 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Well, getting it, Camerano, getting it into a libretto form made a mistake. And in it he says, William is dead,
right. Mm-hmm.
And we will see Mary mount the throne.
Yeah.
And that never happened
in
English history.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, while Mary was dying, William slept on a straw pallet on the floor beside her bed. He wouldn't leave her room.
Hmm.
And she died first. So that never happened.
And they weren't politically at odds with one another. They were co-monarchs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they were in perfect agreement. So even if it had happened, there wouldn't have been any weird thing going on. So that left me going, I've got to fix this because there are too many Anglophiles here. There are too many British subjects here. And William and Mary are famous. And we got to fix that.
Yeah.
So I started looking back through history and found 1485 when Henry Tudor killed
Richard III,
and took the throne. Well, that was the War of the Roses. Everybody's heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
We all know the Yorkists and the Plantagenets, and we all know the Tudors. So, and when the Tudors took over, they weren't nice.
No.
They weren't nice. And
certainly not to the Plantagenets. No.
And there was going to be a killing off.
Yeah.
And that's what Henry's all freaked out about.
Exactly.
He says, I'm facing the axe. I will be dead. It will be your fault, Lucia. If I die, you will see the axe ever before you, because they're going to take his head off. So he's got a lot at stake personally.
Right, exactly.
Even if he didn't have a family to worry about, and even if he hadn't got all the Ravenswood land and money, he's up against a hard place.
Definitely. He's got it coming, too. I mean, the way he came into that fortune to begin with is underhanded in the first place.
Well, that's...
Yeah.
It would be fair play. Turnabout would be fair play in this case, but he's doing everything he can to...
to stop that turnabout.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, we share the same concerns, but by different sides of the sword. We have family interests, and we are the heads of our clans, yeah, basically. So we share a conflict in that way.
I've been reading a lot about Scotland.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's been... And YouTube is such a resource.
Yeah.
There are hundreds of documentaries about, of course, the English aristocracy, the English nobility, the royals, and about Scotland itself.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can look up anything you want. I watched the whole reinterment of Richard III.
Yes, that was a huge story last year.
It was a big story. Yeah. It was a very boring service.
No, they actually found the corpse, the dead boy.
Think. Yeah. Yeah, amazing. And figured out exactly how he got killed. And we now know who killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all that stuff is
researched. Oh, and the Tudor... The Tudor story of his bones, his body, his back were in fact true.
Yeah. He was definitely a twisted guy.
Yeah,
And probably did kill the two princes in the tower.
Yes.
Yeah. So no, it's just crazy. Dead air.
I'll say that I've read the novel and the novel is a lot more about the political machinations that are that is going on behind the scenes. Now, of course, an element of that is present in the opera as well. And it's sort of the reason that all these people are coming together. But it's really, once they're together now, it's really a lot more about the relationship, you know, the love that exists and the pressure that, that people are under. And in that way, we've distilled some real humanity out of what is a good novel, a great novel, but can go on a little long with Scottish brogue and
political that's true.
And that's that don't necessarily have to do with the real humanity of the piece.
What works in literature never works on stage.
No, right. But the novel's so great though, because I mean there are elements that, I mean, it's very Shakespearean with Lady Macbeth comes to mind immediately, and of course there are Romeo and Juliet is all over this opera. With the two lovers being fated, you know, with the hated families, and there's a supernatural element that sort of gets hinted at in the opera at the beginning and in front of that fountain that apparently was very important to Scottish literature, and which is very Macbeth with these three old crones that come and bury old Alice in the opera, and just fortune telling and soothsaying.
Alice was very very different character, Alice. I think she's like
The curious thing for me is about Janice Dalrymple. The Dalrymple is an ancient family, and they were really, really rich, and they built huge homes. I watched a whole thing on just the house that Dalrymple built. It was fascinating. The current Prince of Wales bought it because it still had all of its original furnishings. And it was falling to ruin. The family was losing it, and it was all going to be broken up and sold off in pieces. And the Prince of Wales bought it and is restoring it and is making it a working estate as a museum.
Nice.
So anyway, little Janice Dalrymple is the inspiration for the whole story, because she was forced into a marriage. She was actually, you know, very much in love with, and as far as she was concerned, married somebody else, and then she was forced to marry this guy, and they came into the bridal chamber the next morning, and she was sitting in the cold ashes of the fireplace gibbering, and the guy had been stabbed. He did not die. Nobody knew what happened in that room. He never told. And she died a couple of 6 weeks, a month, 2 months later. She died. He died a long time later. He lived to marry somebody else, and he fell off his horse.
Wow.
And that's how he died. But this actually happened, and it was Tales My Landlord Told Me is the collection from which The Bride of Lammermoor comes.
Wow.
And so it's just an old story that you hear if you live in Scotland, of the story of Janice Dalrymple. Wow. And nobody knows what happened, and they thought perhaps the guy she was in love with was hiding in the bedchamber and stabbed the new husband and fled.
Wow.
Nobody knew what it was. Did she do it? Nobody knew, and he never told. So,
well, it led to an amazing scene in this opera. That
it did lead to an amazing scene.
and plenty of blood in that.
Well, not on the stage, thank you, Jesus. Just basically all over her clothes.
All over her clothes, that's right.
And her little nightgown is a mess. But that mad scene, everybody comes to see Lucia because of the mad scene.
No doubt, yeah. That is the scene.
With all the accretions. I mean, Donizetti wrote, for listeners, Donizetti wrote in a style that was developed first by Rossini. And it was, Rossini went from one aria after the next aria after the next aria after the next aria until you were finished with the show. He used a comic opera format and created what he called a scene. And the orchestra would start playing. The chorus would start, if it's the opening scene, the orchestra is playing, the chorus starts singing. You're going to have an aria. There's going to be an interruption. And then you're going to have an aria that's fast with shorter note values. And then probably the chorus is going to enter in at the conclusion of that second aria, which we call cabaletta for some reason. And it's going to be much faster time. Like if it was in 4-4, now it's in 2-2, and you're just flying through with a big, big rousing end. And that's how each scene is built. So many, many, many scenes in this opera end with everybody singing really loud and somebody singing a really high note, and the orchestra playing tutti, everybody in the orchestra's playing. So the audience always knows when to applaud.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful.
Yeah.
So that's the basic building block, is the scene. And from scene to scene to scene, you can easily, if you're not paying attention to the story, you can easily see the construction of how we go from aria to cabaletta, from aria to cabaletta, with it, with little stuff in between. Even the duets and choruses work on the same principle.
Mm-hmm.
But what that does is almost any time anybody sings an aria, they're very shortly going to be singing a cabaletta right behind it. I mean, everybody basically has two arias. No matter what you do, you come out and sing an aria, you're going to have to turn right around and sing another one that's harder.
Yeah, but disguised in the scene as a new dramatic advancement. That would be
that's
probably
what it
a
is.
Different
that's
thing.
The new information that comes between the two arias.
Mm-hmm.
Like the very first scene for Matt, he comes out saying, I'm mad at this guy. Mm-hmm. And then the new information comes and says, oh, yeah, well, the guy is hitting on your sister. Well, now he's really mad.
He's really mad. Yeah, that, exactly.
So,
yeah. I'm really gonna, you know, just fall upon my sword, and then but she's now dead. Oh no, that's the final
scene.
Heaven. Now I will go with her. Yeah,
it's true. Only unalloyed moment in the opera.
Yes, it's true, and it slows down too. Yeah, which defies the cabaletta.
It was a very very important style of writing. Just all of Verdi's early operas are written in this way, up through Rigoletto, and then they sort of found a new form there, like a through composed thing where you don't always know where scenes are beginning and ending, where the drama flowed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Donizetti is instrumental in furthering that direction. We should make it clear for folks, Rossini. Okay, this whole period in opera parlance is called bel canto, which is Italian for beautiful singing. And if you look in the Harvard Dictionary of Music, you will discover that it covers a long time. Bel canto is a long time. But we who work in opera, we don't think of bel canto as being all that long. We think of it from the first performances of Rossini operas through middle Verdi, through about Traviata. Trovatore, around there. And we think it sort of ends there.
Yeah.
So that's for us the bel canto era. And Rossini developed the style. Bellini furthered the size and length of arias. And then Donizetti continued to push the dramatic verisimilitude until he died in his 50s. So that's the period of the most development. And then Verdi's going to inherit it and just bust the whole form apart. He will just over time just
much more dramatic
wreck it until he finally says, are you still writing cabalettas? I don't write cabalettas anymore.
Yeah.
So it's a period that's really, really interesting. It's just about my favorite period in opera. If the singers can actually sing all the notes and if they understand how to imbue all of that with emotional content.
Yeah, it's very tricky. It's very tricky.
Yeah, it isn't
about
singing.
Challenge.
It's about emoting.
Yeah.
And people get that confused. They think they're going out to sing a vocalese.
Yeah.
And
that's
not what it is. It's not an exercise. This is delivering power.
Yeah.
And all of you are doing it. I mean,
thank you.
I remember giving an interview when we first came here 2 years ago, and I can't remember exactly who I was talking to. She's like, it's this stuff, this opera is so hard. I'm like, well, you just got to know what you're saying, and you need to know what they're saying to you. And if you can know that, you've got a really good start.
Yeah, simple and direct.
I mean,
it's the simplest thing, but it's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
And I have to believe that in this business, when you're on a deadline, people all have their own ideas about, dramatic points or whatever. Some of that can go by the wayside, and you just end up with like a vanilla production. And that's something that I don't enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And at Opera San Jose, because we've worked together for so many years, we have our core of singers, and we have long rehearsal periods. We're able to really work specifically on exactly what this word means to me, what this scene is furthering as far as like a relationship between Edgardo and Enrico, for example. And it's one of the great assets that we have here as a company.
We can really accentuate some of the dramatic contrasts and conflicts.
And really explore how that's going to play out on stage.
Yeah.
And how lucky for stage directors who come here. Of course, Ben Spearman jumped in at the last second. By the way, thanks, Kirk, for telling me I should.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I was glad. Glad it worked out so well. He had a great time and wonderful run of it.
But
great job.
Never had such a long rehearsal period.
Yes, I'm sure of that.
Most of the time we don't.
Yeah.
And he never heard of. And he's been directing all over the country.
Yeah.
But he's never had a staging period as long as this. And he kept telling the stage managers, slow me down if I get ahead because I'll get it all staged in 1 week because that's all I normally get.
Yeah.
So after the first week, then I started coming into rehearsals
say, of course. Well,
could he use a little advice or something because we do it so differently.
Yeah.
And we did have to talk through every single character and many, many, many stage moves. He and I had to talk it through again and again. To finally find motivation for everybody and make it all real drama every minute of it.
And beyond just the luxurious time frame that we operate on, we also have the benefit of working on the sets that we will eventually be putting forth to the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have this massive rehearsal hall here. It's a fantastic rehearsal hall where everything can be fit in. It's this exact size of the stage. And so... most of the time, I would say in my own career, I'm staging an opera on tape on the floor.
Yep.
Stairs are just made in pink tape, and Act 2 then goes to green tape, and Act 3 goes to the orange tape, and you're just walking around little boxes of tape all around stage. But here, we have the hills. We have the stairs. We have the castle. We have the table. We have the knives. And so just right off the bat, you're working with everything that you're going to interact with on stage. And some of that stuff, like, for example, someone who has a sword on stage. This is not, in this day and age, it's a very foreign thing to have a sword in your hand and hanging on your hip. But then this is like a piece of you in that time frame. You have to be able to wield it. You have to be very comfortable with it and how it's, you know, just the way
it's an extension of yourself.
And know where the pointy end is.
Well,
for many reasons, always be careful.
Exactly.
You have to know where the pointy end is.
So working with all of those props and all of those sets from the very beginning just means that you get to live in that world for a lot longer than you can in any other house in America.
Yeah.
And so you really get to be immersed in what we're trying to make.
Yeah, yeah, a lot more production value for a longer time. We have the extra scenery, the gobo of the lighting, very, very mystical, Celtic kind of aspects to this particular production. Our costumes are great.
Oh, they really are pretty costumes. Although everybody's in velvet. All the women are in.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so much fabric in those skirts that if you were to put it on and pick it up and hold it above your head, the fabric at your feet would not have moved yet.
Yeah.
There's that much fabric. There's like three skirts. And it's the overdress and the underdress.
Oh, I think costumes did a glorious job for everybody, though. I mean, usually costumes in other places can be a little flimsier or, you know, they look light on stage. These look really, really heavy, for exterior scenes and interior scenes look great.
And I'm so glad we moved it to 1485.
Because I think so.
I hate 17th century clothes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just different. Yeah,
it's just such unattractive clothes. Men look so stupid with that much lace on.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
This is more of a medieval frock feeling and look.
Yeah, this is Middle Ages. This is chain mail and leather. And,
yeah, with a hint of Celtic, the plaid and tartans. Yeah,
I cracked up when I found out that the tartans were actually not necessarily all that Scottish.
No, yeah, yeah.
That it was actually Sir Walter Scott, who was going to have a royal visit. The King of England was coming to Scotland.
Wow.
And so they wanted to make a big thing for him. So they got together all these guys with caber tosses and all these things, and they created the Highland Games, this giant, and banks of bagpipers.
Yeah.
And then the weavers got together and made all these tartan plaids that they said went back in history to, 800 people who were in their first families. It was all phony baloney.
Yeah.
But it's been completely normal ever after.
And we think
of this as Scotland all the time,
No, of all the sets we've had in our last 2 years, this is one of my favorite sets. With just the drop, the way
giant the tilted, ruined
ruined, beautiful, and the interior keep is fantastic too, and the graveyard.
That first scene when the curtain goes up on the first scene, every single time I just go, God, that's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, that works terrific.
It's just beautiful. All those dead trees.
Yes, wonderful. The trees.
And then you hear coming through the mist, Brigadu.
Yes. Yeah, it's really fantastic. Dear.
Well, Does anybody have anything that they'd like to get out there for anybody to listen to? Oh, what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to my first Marcello in La Boheme. It's hard not to look forward to this world premiere that we're doing.
Absolutely. And Barber. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're doing Alma Viva.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Looking and way forward to that.
You're seeing Figaro?
Figaro. Three performances of Figaro. So, yes. But I got to say, the Silent Night is going to be a big deal. That's
going to
be really nice.
Going to be our probably hugest cast, too.
Oh, by far.
Yeah.
By far. It's the biggest cast we've ever had here for anything.
Yeah.
It's immense. It's ruining the company.
Yeah. that's why I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. That is a lot of soldiers.
Yeah, and a lot of soldiers' costumes. Yeah.
And, yes.
And the scenery is more costly than anywhere near normal.
No, I have no doubt. Yeah,
and the orchestra is more costly than anywhere near normal. It's just it's a huge step to do this.
What an undertaking.
You know, the wonderful thing here is the only other production available in the United States is too big for normal little theaters like ours, you know? There are theaters our size across the United States. Mm-hmm. And nobody could, I mean, only the biggest houses can put the Minnesota Opera set on their stage, and that orchestration requires a pit the size of San Francisco Opera.
Yes.
And when I asked for the perusal score, and I asked for the PBS did a broadcast of the world premiere, and I wrote to Minnesota and, hi, could you help me out? I'd like to see these things. It's terribly, terribly interesting. The Christmas Truce of 1914. Of course, I'd love to know about that. And they sent it out, and Corey and the artistic planning director and the music director and I sat together, and we watched this thing with the score open. And when I realized the size of the orchestra, I knew that we couldn't do it. And then I'm looking at the size of the scenery, which is just immense. So I sent it all back and said, thank you so very much. Wish we could do it, but we can't do it. It's too big for our company in every shape and form. The orchestra's way too big.
Mm.
I got an email from Kevin Putz, the composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, how big is your pit? I said, well, for a Puccini orchestra, 47. But if you want 6 pianos, 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, Carl Orff wrote an Antigone for 11 pianos.
Oh, my goodness.
He sent a new orchestration for 47.
So we had this conversation at some event about Streetcar Named Desire too. Is that we used a reduced orchestration? Super important to have these things so that the art can be disseminated to every place on the planet. Because when you can only be in the biggest houses, then you're only going to reach a small number of people.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you know, going forward, we'll have paved the way for this piece to get to a lot more people.
Sets that work on a stage our size, a complete set of costumes, props, and an orchestration. Everything people need to put this thing on.
Mm-hmm.
So it can travel now to Santa Barbara.
There you go.
I mean, it can go to, what's in Texas? The company, company in Texas.
Austin.
Yeah. It can, lots of places. Memphis. I mean, it can go to all these places around the country. The way it stands now, only the biggest companies can produce it. So we're kind of doing a service to the art form as well as...
You're welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, the benefits of living composers, you know? Yeah.
And we're presenting the West Coast
Living
premiere.
Musicians, yeah.
So that's cool.
That's great.
The premiere I'm looking forward to next year is The Revolution of Steve Jobs in Santa Fe. As a matter of fact, it's all booked.
Wow.
The tickets are purchased. The hotel is booked. It's all set. And the president of the board is going, and some of our major donors are going. And we're just going to make a little trip to Santa Fe next year so that we can see The Revolution of Steve Jobs. Because, I mean, that's Mason Bates. Okay. How and Mark that? Campbell, who wrote the
libretto.
Oh, this is the libretto for this. Exactly. Yeah.
And he's doing so many libretti right now. I mean, he just did The Shining
broke The Shining, all box office records in Minnesota. The Manchurian Candidate, did he not? Or was it Manchurian?
I'm not sure if he did Manchurian, but I know he did The Shining.
Yeah.
He probably did Manchurian also, and certainly Silent Night.
Yeah.
So, and he's creating the libretto for The Revolution of Steve Jobs.
Outstanding.
And Mason Bates is, I mean, he's the darling of every symphony orchestra in America. And this will be his first opera. So how exciting is that? Now, whether or not we'll get to produce it,
yeah.
in the Bay Area anytime yeah. soon. I don't know. We'll see who gets the rights.
Yeah, that's okay. Always the tricky part with the living.
Everybody here will want to do it.
Musicians, yeah. Composers.
But my understanding is it's not a huge opera. That is, it doesn't require great forces. It's not a giant orchestra, and it's not a huge cast. And it's very personal and intimate. A real look at Steve Jobs looking back on his life after he's discovered he has terminal cancer.
Hmm.
So it's a different perspective on this guy who we think of as the razzmatazz guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's the Pied Piper out there. Hmm. But at the end of his life, he had a real struggle and had to look at some things.
Wow.
And so I'm really excited about seeing it. And I hope once I've seen it, I'm really excited about producing it.
Yeah, that's a different story.
I think we should have it here. Well, that's enough about the future. The future is nebulous. Nobody knows what's in it.
Yeah.
Well, guys, you've been kind enough to come here and spend your whole afternoon.
That's a pleasure.
Hanging around here. And I'll let you go. Thank you. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Of Thanks, course. Larry.
Singing yeah. brilliantly, acting brilliantly,
thank
and then
you.
Sharing what you're doing. Thanks so much.
See you, everybody. Thank you.